And let's go ahead and get started with Mark.
Oh, thank you very much. Nice, my microphone is...
Hold it right up to you.
Oh, okay. First, I wanted to thank the Society for our first place award. I wasn't here to receive it on Wednesday night. Misty Edgecombe, who did the yeoman work on the writing, was here and received it for our newspaper. Unfortunately, Misty left the news shortly after, just before we published Climate Change. She had other opportunities, and we made her feel guilty as she walked out the door. And but she's here sitting in the back with Kevin Miller, to whom we passed the torch as an environmental writer at the Bangor Daily News. But I just wanted to thank the SCJ for the award. We're humbled by it. We're very proud of the product and really honored to have received that first place award. My charge here this morning is to tell you a little bit about our project. First, a little bit about our paper. We're Bangor Daily News is a medium-sized, independent, family-owned newspaper in central Maine. We have a circulation of about 60,000 on the weekdays, 70,000 on the weekends. And three very strong forces pushed us to work on this climate change project, which Rob already held it up. It took us about a year, a little over a year, to pull a project together. We take our newspapers and education program very, very seriously. We're constantly looking for projects that will have broad public appeal, but which also would have application in the classroom. And as we got into this whole climate change process and began to rough it out, and Misty pulled an outline together, we realized that what we thought we'd be able to produce would conform to the state's learning results, which is key for classroom teachers. They'll bring something into the classroom if it will work within the matrix of the learning results program in the state. So we were very careful to look at that. Second, we're the dominant newspaper in Maine from the Kennebec River to Canada. It's the northern two-thirds of the state. Lots of trees, lots of moose. Not as many people as they have in the southern part of the state, but we're the dominant paper, and we take our responsibility very seriously to present, you know, complex issues to our readership. And, of course, the challenge with a complex issue is to make it interesting and inviting. And last, because our economy and our people, our heritage, the fabric of our, frankly, our society in Maine, very similar to Vermont and New Hampshire, is based on traditional natural resource-based industries, fishing, farming, now ecotourism, potato growing. People are very aware of weather and, of course, confuse weather and climate, which I'll get to later. That confusion, although we tried to dispel it, works to your advantage when it comes to marketing the product. Our people are so connected to weather that it seemed like a natural thing for us to do. And then we looked north about my office looks out on the Penobscot River, which many of you are probably aware is a center of kind of chronic controversy and discussion as we try to restore natural genetic strains of Atlantic salmon. So on a good day, now that we have a season restored, you can almost look out the window and upriver, and there are salmon fishermen there. About 8 miles upriver is the University of Maine and its Climate Change Institute. And the University of Maine is really its Department of Quaternary Studies is really a cutting edge research organization, and it had received attention really all over the world for its work, but it had scant, if any, attention in the press in the United States. And we said, my God, you know, this is in our backyard. This is something we really need to look at. We've got to talk to those folks at the university. The culture of the university and its scientific academics and our journalists, of course, are very different. The scientists rely on grants and public support that is very sensitive to politics. They needed a straight presentation of the information. Shorn of spin and scrupulously accurate in its details, they wanted to involve other university departments in the actual writing and research of the pieces. They wanted to control the content, the perspective. They were concerned about accuracy. Their concerns were valid, and we understood them. Our first responsibility, of course, is to our public, and we demand freedom of inquiry and expression. Our approaches to the project had the potential to clash, but there are two reasons why that clash never occurred. First, we met with them face-to-face and explained that our primary objective as a newspaper was identical to that of the Institute. We intended to produce a section that explained the science of climate change in the most visually inviting and comprehensive way that we could, given our resources. And we'd leave it up to our readers to make up their own minds about the impact of human and natural influences on our climate based on the best research available. That approach would work for both of us by preserving their integrity and independence as researchers and our credibility as a newspaper. More important, we built relationships. Over the months we worked on this project, the men and women of science learned that the reporters, photographers, and graphic designers placed as strong a premium as they did on thoroughness of research and accuracy. I mean, we had discussions, a number of discussions. We said, trust us, let's work together. And then over the course of several months, people did work together. And Eric Zells, our graphics editor, who with his assistant Jonathan Ferland designed this section, explained his experiences for me this way. He said, we knew early on that the package would be visuals heavy. So this was a good starting point to demonstrate we could present their scientific data accurately. What do climate change models look like? What information is to be conveyed? The similarities of our two missions soon became apparent as we looked and talked graphically. Eric said it was as if the Rosetta Stone had been placed before us, as we soon realized that our common language for displaying all the information the Climate Change Institute and others had to present was through graphics, a tool in newspapering, too. We looked at the flowing dynamic computer models. We discovered how to do that static representation for print. We felt confident in our given field, so our exchanges were frank and constructive. Eric worked very closely with a couple of people at the Climate Change Institute, and this went on for about a year. Make no mistake, building trust required us to walk the wire at times and reassuring our full-time academic source and occasional collaborator that we intended to publish a document that would be factually accurate. When we finally did publish Climate Change, it was in January of this year. It was an excellent time to do it. Winter's a terrific time to publish anything in Maine on climate. The kids are in school. The teachers are looking for science material. Even though we did everything we could to explain the difference between weather and climate change, if we published and it was cold and snowing, that people would blame climate change for it, and if the tulips were coming up through the mulch in the front yard, that they'd also blame climate change. And we sold an additional 4,500 copies, which for us is a big deal. I gave you a sense of scale for our newspaper. We had, many hundreds of requests after that for copies from schools and colleges, universities across the country. We had, as I say, accolades, this award, but what really brought home to me that we'd succeeded was a letter that we got to the editor, and I'll just read a paragraph of it for you. It's called Climate Change Alert. The Bangor Daily News January 12 insert on climate change, our changing world, was such a disappointment. With the risks of catastrophic climate change as high as they are, a report as extensive as this one should always include a strong and clear call to change. Consume less, drive less, repair your relationship to the natural world, work for policy change. Scientists should be saying publicly, we don't understand climate very well, but we know enough to feel the urgency of the situation. Human beings need to change their behavior. When I read that letter, I said, we succeeded. We gave the public the information it needed to feel strongly about this issue. This person felt strongly enough to write in and say, I want to do something. Clearly, she understood what she needed to do. Thank you.
Thanks. tulips in Maine in January, that really strikes me odd. I guess it just goes to show you that they say what the saying is that climate's what you expect and weather's what you get. Yeah. Betsy.
I'm also going to start by thanking the SDJ for a lovely award, which I also wasn't here to get, but I am very honored and grateful for. And I also just wanted to say that it's very appropriate that we're all in Burlington this morning. After I wrote my series on climate change, I took off a couple months from the New Yorker to expand it into a book, and I scratched my head and thought, what haven't I said in these 30,000 words? And the one thing that really was glaringly obvious was, what can we do? And who's doing it? What are people doing? And that brought me to Burlington. I spent a while here. The former mayor, I guess he's no longer the mayor, Pete Clavel, took me around to show me some really innovative projects that Burlington has undertaken, which is really a leader in this whole area of locally trying to tackle climate change. If you haven't been to the Burlington Electric Department, they have a little windmill, and I think I wrote that they are the only municipal utility in the country whose vehicle fleet includes bicycles. So they are really ahead of the curve here. I know that the title of this morning's panel is the biggest story, the biggest challenge, and when I was thinking about how to address that, I immediately realized, that talking about the fact that it was the biggest story was pretty much superfluous, because none of you would be here if you didn't know that. I certainly wouldn't be here if it weren't the case. So I think at 7:30 to get this many people out, we all know that this is the biggest story. So I'm going to just sort of pass over that and go right to the challenges. And I know that I also speak from sort of an odd vantage point. I write for a magazine that gave me a lot of time and a lot of space, both of which are increasingly luxuries, certainly in the print journalism world. On the other hand, when you have a lot of time and you have a lot of space, you end up running into just about every challenge that there is. And I can tell you, that I have the scars to prove that. So I do think that I can speak to all the challenges that exist in this enormous story. So what are those challenges? Well, I don't want to be too pedantic about it, but I think they fall into roughly two categories, although there is a lot of overlap. And the first category is challenges that individual reporters are going to run into with individual stories. And the most obvious one, I think, is that there's a real tension between what makes a good story and what you can say about climate change in a scientifically rigorous way. And Mark sort of alluded to that. What captures people's imagination is a story. It's a real story about a specific place, a specific moment in time. In climate change, you could say a storm or a heat wave. But as we all know, any given weather event cannot be attributed to climate change. What is the really compelling evidence for climate change? Well, it's these huge aggregations of data over many years by definition, are outside of any one person or even any one community's experience. So there's a huge tension right away. Then second of all, what is journalism about? Well, it's about stories. It's also about conflict. And I think that here, once again, we have a tremendous problem. Global warming is not about conflict. It is a phenomenon. It is happening. Everyone, once again, in this room knows that. And to the extent that it's gotten shoehorned into the category of stories about conflict, I think a tremendous disservice has been done, and we can talk about that later if you want, both to the story and, I have to say, to the truth. And then another problem is that global warming is always prospective. So when I started to do my series, it was actually at a moment, it was around 2003, 2004, where people were increasingly saying, look, we now have data sets. We can point to phenomena, and we can attribute them to global warming, the shrinking of the Arctic ice cap, let's say. But really, what are these people worried about? They're not worried about what you can already see happening, which is, alarming enough. They are worried about what is already built into the system. system. So the real problems of climate change are always in the future. And to get people to understand that this is going to happen in the future, it is inexorable. It is in the pipeline. It is going to happen in the future. That is a huge challenge for journalism. We tend to deal very much with what happened yesterday. And climate change is not what happened yesterday. It's what's happening 20, 30, 40 years from now that we already have determined. So I think those are all, you know, any one of those, I have to say, would be a tremendous challenge for journalism, journalists. But I think there's another sort of challenge which I'm just going to touch on briefly, and that is the challenge which I will say to, you know, for sort of a lack of a better phrase, is the challenge to our whole profession. And in this, I have to say, I don't think we've performed very well. And I hesitate to say this because I am a reporter and I am a great partisan of the media, and it seems to me that people are always blaming the media for things that are not really the media's fault. They're using, you know, information they got in the New York Times to fault the New York Times for not covering these issues, and that seems to me really unfair. And it seems to me that people are often blaming the media for things that rightfully belong at the feet, to be honest, of the public and the electorate. But in the case of climate change, you can say, well, once again, in this vein, you can say, well, have we provided the public with the information that they need to understand this issue? And in a very narrow sense, I think we have. If you want to know about climate change, you can find many, many, many sources of information and get a very good understanding of this issue. But I want to say that I think that the obligation of the media is more than that. People do look to the media to tell them what is important, what leads the nightly news, what leads the front page of the paper. And in that sense, I have to say I really think we've failed. If you are going to give global warming the kind of play that it deserves in terms of the significance of the story, then it would be on the news or on the front page, if not every single day, then certainly every other day. And I think we can all agree that that hasn't happened. And when you start to think about what kind of impact that would have, if this story were on the front page or on the news every single night for a month, it would be huge. So I really hope that, I know that there's one editor sitting next to me, I hope there's a lot of editors and news directors in this room, because it seems to me that we are abrogating our responsibility if we sit here waiting for news to happen, because that is not the way climate change works. And we, just like the politicians in Washington, are going to have something to answer for here in the future. And all of our kids, you know, are going to be there to make sure that we answer for it. So once again, I don't want to, you know, get into media bashing, but I do want to challenge us as a profession to do better. Thanks.
Thanks, Betsy. We're going to see if Rick is next, and I think he has a clip to show us. We're hoping we have all the technical bugs worked out.
Just a minute. I'll kind of set things up a little bit first. My name is Rick Capcella, and I'm a local news anchor and reporter in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm more of a generalist. I'm as likely to be working on public pensions or prescription drugs as I am climate change. But the reporting that I do, I've been very lucky at CARE Television. The reporting that I do is pretty much earmarked for the key rating periods during the course of the year, November, February, May. So if I'm working on something in August, it's for November. And I do get to spend a lot of time on individual issues that we're focused on at the time. Elizabeth's point, some of these points are just so ringing with me in their truthfulness, some of the challenges that we face covering this particular story. I got to tell you, though, and you're going to see this clip in just a moment, first a few minutes of about 30 minutes that we produced on CARE 11 News at 10 o'clock back in February. But what we really, I think, tried to push this issue harder. We tried to position this issue as about specific events, not about somewhere else, but about where we live, and not about later, about now. And I think that we are in a place where you can find these things with science. I mean, we didn't do this on our own, obviously. We were working with U.S. Fish and Wildlife. We were working with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources and several scientific groups in Minnesota. But I want to tell you that how we got to reporting this was it started with a sound bite that we heard on public radio from a well-respected climatologist in Minnesota, who had made the statement that if you're looking to measure the impact of climate change in North America, there's almost no better place to do it than Minnesota, he said, because you're smack in the middle of the continent, you're protected from the influences of the oceans, and there are a lot of things to see. And that kind of tripped our trigger and just got us digging, started with a phone conversation directly to him, and then went into just good old-fashioned research, digging through things. It's amazing the stuff that we came upon fairly quickly. The most holy smokes element to me was that I was going through minutes of a meeting of a consortium of scientists that had taken place 3 years ago. Okay? Online, I'm going through these minutes. And there's a guy that had shown up at these meetings who was a recently retired Department of Natural Resources wildlife biologist who says, well, you know about the situation with the moose in northern Minnesota. We have two herds in northern Minnesota. The moose is kind of an icon of the state like it is out here, you know. This guy just kind of announced that, well, one of those herds was gone. It was deceased, and that they had disappeared over the course of the prior 10 to 15 years. That's a news story in and of itself, regardless of any suggestion that it has anything to do with climate change. But we found it first, most shockingly, to have been factual, that was actually true. You know, where was that story? I don't know. I still can't tell you where the story was. It has been reported much more broadly now. I think what I'd like to do at this moment is take a look at the tape. This is the first 3 minutes of the first night on climate change in Minnesota. Parasites are not supposed to kill.
Can you rewind that tape? Can I start that again? Because you're at about almost the end.
Scientists. The most impressive poster child for what's happening on this planet right now may very well be right there. The moose. As great an icon of northern Minnesota as any animal's ever been. Big, strong, and as scientists have known for quite some time, very sensitive to temperature.
Moose are very well adapted to cold temperature and deep snow, but above about 67 degrees Fahrenheit, moose begin to get heat stress.
Mike Schrag and his colleagues have spent years counting moose in Minnesota. There are two herds here, the northeast and northwest. The northwest herd is in serious trouble.
It used to be probably the largest, most productive herd in the state, and it just crashed.
There were 4,000 moose here in the late 80s. Today, 250. The rate of pregnancy is low, half what's normal. And moose are dying here faster than normal. Scientists tell us it's not that heat is killing the moose, but it's a lot of extra stress on the animal. Specifically, these moose died from parasites, brain worms, and liver flukes.
It appeared that those parasites tended to cause those individual moose to starve to death, which is really contrary to what parasites are supposed to do.
Oh, he wants to bite the one in the timber.
Parasites are not supposed to kill the animal. In trying to figure out why this is happening, scientists have become very focused on temperature.
If you're a moose and it's middle of summer and you're panting, you just have less time for eating.
The moose are dying in greatest numbers within a year of a very hot summer. Overall, the climate on our planet is up just 1 degree Fahrenheit in the last 100 years. Now, that may not sound like much, but it's the biggest heat gain on the planet since before the Middle Ages, 1,000 years. And much of that heat is recent. The 10 hottest years of the last century were in the last 15 years. In fact, in northwest Minnesota, where the moose are dying, the growing season has increased 39 days in the last 41 years.
I mean, you can't ignore them.
Record dew points make it feel even hotter than it is.
Last summer, summer of 2005, we had dew points in the 80s. 80s. This is like Bombay, India. This isn't like Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota.
She gets so hot.
We've seen dew points in the 80s here seven of the last eight summers. The supersaturated hot air can spur greater storms. Precipitation is up here 20% in the last century. The massive blowdown in the Boundary Waters canoe area is just one consequence of all that extra rain and wind. I want to tell you, somewhat embarrassingly, okay, as I explain, I'm more of a generalist. On this particular issue of climate change, I got to say, prior to doing the research, had not formed definitive conclusions, okay? This was last year this time, looking at the issue. I kind of went into it thinking, oh, no. You know, this is something that is hard enough to even prove what it is that's happening, let alone why it is happening. But as I got into researching the issue, I came to the conclusion that what has really been frustrating is the lack of greater context for journalists, for the public at large, to understand that the consensus, okay, the consensus that is out there, it is not universal. We did not say that there's only one school of thought on this. But I'll tell you, we did not spend very much time at all with naysayers. This goes to what I think is a critical problem in this issue, particularly in this issue. I've heard it described as the bias of balance. Okay? This idea, as journalists, that if we got somebody saying one thing, we got to run out so that we can be balanced and get somebody to say the opposite. That is weak-kneed journalism. It is a kind of journalism that is, frankly, very destructive to the substance of issues like the one we have on the table here. I'm going to conclude there. We can talk more about this or other elements of this issue later in this part of the program. Bill.
Take it away, Bill.
Thanks very much. I'm very honored to be asked to speak here because I don't consider myself an environmental journalist. I've been covering all kinds of other things for ABC News over the years. I'm a professional journalist. And, of course, as we all know, the two words media and journalist are not in any way synonymous. Media are physical things, and there are many professions that use the media. One of them is professional journalists, which is what we are, professional skeptics. I think of a journalist as someone, two definitions I have of journalist. A journalist is someone who knows when the deadline approaches how not to report what he does not know, surprisingly rare skill on this planet, and also that it is the journalist's job to change his mind as often and as well as he honestly and usefully can. I believe that basically part of the essence of our profession, well, to put it this way, the difference between a propagandist and a journalist. Propagandists are people who try to hide their biases from you. Journalists are not people who put their biases aside when they work. I believe that we are people who are professional skeptics. We are people who recognize that all communication is biased. And so that what we do is we have ways, many different ways of being open about our biases, and here's the trick. We're not just open about our biases. We don't only tell the audience, hey, we're all blind men at the elephant, you have to listen to a bunch of us. We are constantly putting our biases to the test as best as we can perceive them. And that's how we do journalism, by constantly testing what we think is the case. That's what the spinners don't understand or don't want to understand, and propagandists have to hide their own biases from themselves or they go crazy, and they sort of do anyway. When I stumbled into this story 2 years ago, I found something quite surprising. I had the disadvantage of having been spun by talking to a then greatly respected hurricane scientist about 10 years ago doing a story on hurricanes. And after the camera was off, I said, what about this global warming? He said, oh, there's nothing to it. And I just read James Gleick's Chaos, and I said, too many butterflies? He said, yeah, too many butterflies. And they can never figure out whether there's any global warming here. So I didn't pay attention until 2 years ago, when in 2004, I called up Alan Pounds, down the scientist down in the Monteverde Cloud Forest studying Golden Toad, and said, Alan, 10 years ago we did a story based on you about how all the amphibians around the world were going extinct or disappearing. Can we do a 10-year later story? Do you have any idea yet why they disappeared? And he said, oh, yeah, we now know. I said, you're kidding. I said, no. He said, what? Global change, climate change. I said, you're kidding. He said, no. And he told me not about one, but three different meta-studies, each study is of hundreds of studies, all of them in Nature, all of them, each of them different from the others, all of which had shown one way or another that the natural world was already scattering and in serious trouble. And as you all know, the Thomas et al. Paper said 18 to 35% extinct or on the road to extinction by the middle of the century. I said, ooh, bit of a story. Looked into it and found, to my shock, that there was a massive gap. I agree with everyone on the panel here about this. We have failed, and we failed for 10 years. I became intrigued about why, tried to start getting the story on the air, and I'd just like to offer a couple of quick thoughts about that, about why we got so spun and didn't do so well in mainstream media. And there's a number of reasons, I believe. Of course, the balances bias was one of the big ones, and the people from ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal and a few, there's a very few politicians left, but they're still trying, of course, could play on the idea that we have to be balanced. That was one of the reasons, initially a good reason, I think, that we failed. Because in America, the land of the First Amendment, there is a presumption that because we're free, our responsibility is really to the political process initially. This somehow is deep in our structure somehow. And so, you know, the framers of the First Amendment were really just trying to make sure that that this new king they'd invented called the president would have a free-speaking opposition. The First Amendment says nothing about telling the truth, nothing about professional journalism. In fact, it asks you to be free. It gives freedom to propagandists. We professional journalists do not require the First Amendment. Some of the greatest acts of professional journalism happen in the most oppressive countries. We love the First Amendment. We may die for the First Amendment. We love to have it whenever we can get it, and some have died for the First Amendment. We don't require it. And I think that's part of how we got a little bit tricked into you got to show the other side. But there's another aspect to why we caved in so often to showing the other side. One of the basic principles I discovered as I started looking into this, and I should say parenthetically, the other morning on GMA, one of the anchors called me, Bill, we're glad you're here. We know you're so passionate about global warming, and I cringed. I don't need to hear somebody think that I'm passionate about anything in the story, and I am not. It is not my job to save the environment. I'm not passionate about anything in the story more than any other human on the planet would be. I mean, can I see the hands, please, of everybody be happy to have the environment collapse? I mean, at any convention, right-wing, left-wing, any, no hands are going to go up, right? I tend to get intense about stories. We all do. But I am a little bit extra passionate about something in this one, but it has nothing to do with global warming and the environment. My own intensity about the story has to do with the deep professional shame that I discovered two years ago when I had the advantage of having been spun. So I came in all at once to the story and said, my God, the reality out there is completely different from the mindset in our buildings. Now, there are some heroes, a number of them, who for years have been fighting the story, and we're standing on the shoulders of these giants. I mean, Elizabeth is one. Andy is one. Everybody up here is one. There's so many great professional journalists who've been working on it. Andy Revkin, who will be here later. But one of the things I discovered was the following principle. I mean, clearly, all criticism has to be listened to, but it also has to be judged. And this is where our editors very often let us down, and we did too. When a naysayer, a denier comes up and criticizes, you have to listen. But then you have to go to the trouble of checking it out and seeing if, in your own personal opinion, this is something equivalent to maybe the proverbial Flat Earth Society. And as I discovered with a little bit of basic work, with all of the deniers by the time I got into it, they had nothing. They had nothing. Basic, self-respecting, looking into it, showed that the people who were, and as we know, the small handful of scientists who let themselves take money from and say things that Exxon, Peabody Coal, American Petroleum Institute like, they had nothing. The problem was that we were still, in journalism, there was still this science phobia. You know, you think after tobacco we would have learned, but as Ross Gelbspan and others have written, the PR firms did the same thing for the oil companies here, and tricked us or our editors with phrases like, well, you got to let the scientists argue among themselves, to which the answer is, no, we don't. Excuse me. I'm a professional journalist. Don't tell me how to do my job. I'm going to go find out for myself. And so I approached this story the way I'd approached all the various wars I'd covered and the various popes I'd covered. A journalist is someone who knows how not to report when the deadline comes what he does not know. Parachute journalism is nothing to apologize for. All good journalism is parachute journalism. And the first day of a story in a country that nobody has heard about, the last person you're going to want to hear from is a professor. You're going to want to hear from a professional journalist who on the first day in there doesn't know much, but knows he doesn't, and starts reporting. Well, what little I do know is this. And by the third week, fourth week, the reporting gets even more interesting. And I found out after a little bit of looking into these magazines, journals like Nature and Science and all that, scientists aren't that hard to understand. Sometimes you have to read the article two or three times and you look at the bold summary at the beginning, but I found that scientists, in fact, were a bit easier to understand than politicians or financiers or all of the other people that we covered, and you just go into it. The problem was, and I agree with everybody on the panel, that we journalists had not stood up on our own feet and said, excuse me, this is going to be my assessment of where the scientific assessment is, because those spinners would say, you've got to listen to who for the scientific assessment, and they'll point to their favorite organization. I even realized that part of the problem was how to assess what the scientists feel, and I started finding experts in that. Granger Morgan at Carnegie Mellon, who is very well known, for example, with his ability, his new techniques for assessing a broad range of scientists for their opinion on any one scientific issue. Well, there's so much to talk about, but let me just finally close with one general thought. Among the many obstacles which had spun us so well for 10 years, it was clear to me that there are a lot of psychological obstacles that make this also the biggest and most difficult story that we've ever come across. There's an existential one. None of us like to think that we could have hurt when we're kids, that we could do anything to change our nurturing parents. We're looking at serious mainstream scientists now tell us that maybe it's over. Hard. This is the kind of news you have to take in small doses. That's James Lovelock. James Hansen, who is one of the more optimistic mainstream scientists, doesn't disagree with many of the things that Lovelock believes. He just has more optimism about the ability of humanity to get its act together and cut the greenhouse gases. The fact of our own mortality is hard to take. There's the natural denial we hear when we hear bad news, what I call the Cessna, which is in the minds of almost all of us. The Cessna first appeared in your mind when you first heard the words, hey, did you hear a plane has just flown into one of the trade towers? You thought, oh, well, some little plane, whether it was a terrorist or a drunk or a suicide or just a foggy day, it was a little plane. I found out almost everybody immediately imagined a little plane. It's the natural tendency that I think we all have, to assume the least possible bad given the terrible news we just heard. Denial is initially natural and healthy. The psychologists tell us it's what we do to hold our meaning system together so we can at least function at first when trauma happens. And we're all being delivered a major trauma here. And so I'll just end with this thought. I realized that one of the things I came to realize early on when I was suddenly full of fire about this because of this professional failure, I came to realize after I sent a couple of memos upstairs and was getting very little response that I was going to have to be patient and sympathetic also with my bosses. I didn't get immediate responses. Oh, yes, indeed. Let's do a whole week on the air right now on every platform. Of course, don't get me wrong. I'm very proud to work for ABC because they immediately let me start working and do what I do. But I also realized that no two people, no two editors, no two people in the audience are going to have the same medley of denial needs, and if you don't have denial on this, you're not paying attention, the same medley of internal denial needs and little gaps in their scientific knowledge. As everybody said here, it's by far the biggest story we've ever had, and so we still have an awful lot of work to do to get our arms around it, but I think in the recent months we've seen the beginning of a watershed on that.
Okay, folks, we're going to skip the moderator's prerogative to questions. You can get right in line now. There are two mics. One's right there. One's right there. Want to see blue badges. Blue badges first, okay? Who has got a question? Room full of journalists. Okay, I can start asking questions. Bill, you mentioned the hurricane forecaster, and I'll ask everybody on the panel who wants to comment on this, but you in particular, what do you say about the fact that many meteorologists now are standing up and saying we don't believe that climate change is happening?
I don't know what to say about it. I do know I've heard stories of one major network, not mine, where they tried a year ago to decide that the weather forecaster once a week was going to be mentioning and global, you know, global climate change is related in this way, and they were immediately sat on by, I was told, I haven't checked it out, but I was told by Ross Gelbspan, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning editor, that they were sat on by a powerful advertising interest. Two things I'll say about that. One, we still have a lot of work to do in helping the audience understand, but they're not dumb, they'll get it, this is third grade science, that weather is not climate, as you've heard a number of other people up here say. This is the kind of thing that makes some science phobic editor say, oh, it's too complicated, and would make a third grade teacher say, oh, good, something fun to teach my kids today. You know, there's this horrible science phobia. The good thing is that the internet is here, and so the networks are now going for the younger demographic that gets. Another minor detail: we have ourselves some logic problems yet to work out. There's this phrase, you know, you can't blame anyone, you can't blame global warming on any one horrible storm. Well, that's not exactly right either. To suggest that there's a question about whether any storm or any other storm has global warming in it, it would be to imply that it's possible for it not to. Here's the truth, and I don't think, as far as I can understand it from the scientists, I'm not a scientist. If global warming is real, then it affects everything in the weather, everywhere, all the time, at every instant. So the question is not, can you blame it on this one horrible hurricane? The question is rather, of course, to be precise, does this fit in with exactly the predicted pattern that they told us 30 or 40 years ago we would see more and more of because of climate change? Those little logical problems that we journalists can still work on and solve.
Okay. Anybody else?
Hi, I'm Murray Carpenter. I'm a freelance journalist from Belfast, Maine. And your comments are all great. Everyone is criticizing the mainstream media, and my one question is, isn't this sort of inherently a strength of the mainstream media, that it's not going to flip around all of a sudden on an issue and jump right in, but that, you know, it's like an ocean liner. It's heading in one direction, and it maybe takes a lot of force to get it to you know, change around. And I know it's a contrarian view, but I wonder what you all would think about that.
I have to disagree with that. I don't think our job is to wait around until, you know, the world changes, the rest of the world changes its mind. I mean, if you think about that logically, that means like when the public opinion polls tell us that, you know, the world has reached a different conclusion, we'll follow. I hope everyone believes it's the job of the media to get out in front with the facts, not necessarily with a judgment, but to get out in front with the facts. And that is, you know, something that I think, you know, once again, time and time again at this table, we've all said, well, we all woke up. We woke up. There was this huge body of scientific literature and these enormous conclusions that had been reached by the scientific community that hadn't gotten out to the public. And I don't think there's any way to really say that that's a virtue of journalism, in my opinion.
Anybody else? It's also, I found it very frustrating, and I'm going to look for opportunities to talk with more and more scientists because I was stunned, even in the course of the work in Minnesota, that within, for instance, the Department of Natural Resources, the people with the moose information were stunned to find out that there was similar information in the Department of Natural Resources by the people who study fish. And the people who studied fish were stunned to find out about the moose. And that was within one group, okay, let alone separately. As much as anything else, I mean, our basic job is to get the information out, just as Elizabeth said, but we got to do more to coax it out, too, from particularly the scientific community that is not even talking to itself.
A quick word about laziness. I think it was very lazy of us for 10 years, our editors, when we were asked for balance, often from the spinners, we just gave up and said, okay, we'll put the other side on. Okay, are you happy now? And that saved us from the trouble of having to check out the fact that these other side were the proverbial flat earth society. So, again, I certainly agree that it's our job to... We let ourselves be spun. Professional failure.
Quick question. Can you all in the back hear from these audience mics? Is that okay? All right, great. Sue? One other thing. Questioners, please identify yourself, your name and your affiliation.
Okay, hi. Is this on? Okay. Hi, I'm Sue Jewell. I'm a freelance writer. My question is, all the stories I've heard in the last few years or read, they're showing very well the direct correlation, the temperatures going up and therefore the moose are dying and the polar caps are melting. And there's a good direct correlation, but I'm actually a scientist first, and as a scientist, I say the direct correlation doesn't necessarily mean cause and effect. It could just be coincidence. There was one story that I read years ago, and I wish I could remember where it was, but it actually had more of a compelling argument that you couldn't deny, and I haven't seen it since. And what the facts were was that scientists can tell from the polar ice caps, they can take the different layers and show where the molecules of the particles came from. They can track a molecule to a specific volcano or an incinerator. And that was more compelling to me. And I haven't seen it since, not in the Time magazine article, not even Al Gore. It's just been the correlation.
I think Betsy covered some of this.
I would like to take that up because I think that's a huge issue, and it's also been a huge point that as Bill's referring to the flat earthers have mentioned, correlation doesn't mean causality. The ice cores that you're talking about, I have to say, I don't see where causality comes into that. I've been at ice coring operations. Ice coring tells you the history of the climate, but it doesn't tell you. It's not. I don't see how you're gonna. And I defer to any scientist in the room. I don't know how you're gonna, coax causality out of that. The fact is that the principles of global warming, as any climatologist will tell you, are as well established basically as the principles of gravity. Okay. So to keep futzing around about causality is really to just not be taking the scientific method on its face. It's quite possible that some of the warming that we have seen in recent years, some of it is natural, okay? But if you look at climate models, which have been predicting for 30 years exactly what is happening, and now it is happening, that is basically in the scientific world considered to be proof. And if we keep sitting around waiting for, I don't know what would constitute proof at that point, okay? There is nothing that could constitute proof. It could always be that 1 in 2 trillion chance that, yes, this is just coincidence. But no scientist who looks at the basic physics of global warming says that it is possible to add as much greenhouse gases to the atmosphere as we have and not warm the planet up. It just isn't possible. And now we are seeing that warming coming out the other end, and so that constitutes as good a proof as you are ever going to get. And if you sit around and wait for better proof, you're going to be underwater one day.
Yeah.
One of the other frustrating pieces of this is that the conversation has been for years now successfully the challenge has been prove it definitively, prove it. And I think as journalists we've looked at it and gone, oh crap, we can't exactly prove it. But the real answer is that's not what science does. Science does not prove things unequivocally, almost never. Like gravity is as close, as great as anything. This, I think, is second to it. But the whole notion of the challenge being that this must come with absolute proof is a false challenge.
To quote Karl Popper, the great philosopher of science, absolute proof and absolute truth are not concepts that belong to anything in science. They belong only to some areas of mathematics and formal logic, and even in those cases, it's challenged. It's just not what science does. Science is always about, as Popper and others have shown, improving our perspective. We never see the whole thing. Of course, there's always going to be that something could be because of something else. But our human condition is that all we can do is keep improving the perspective. And in this way, science and professional journalism overlap completely. Nearly
okay.
Completely.
Okay, we've got about 15 minutes, so let's get through as many questions as we can. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is John Daly. I'm a reporter with KSL Television in Salt Lake City. And I was wondering if you could talk about the influence of advertisers, ratings, these kind of things on covering this issue. I know personally I've gone to the boss and pushed to do more stories about this and had him tell me, you're making me nervous and, you know, we're not NPR. So I'm just wondering if you feel like there's a role or that's had an impact on the slowness at which the media has kind of got on this issue.
Rick, I want you to take that one.
I don't know that the advertising one is an interesting question. I don't know what the advertising the counter advertising thing would be. The way to get around the editors or to deal with the editors on issues like this is to find the story, to find what is the hook. When I came back and said, this is what we found happening to moose, this is what we found with these certain species of fish, and we have scientists that are saying that this is, in the matter of the fish, they were saying, there are lots of reasons why this might be, but we know that this fish does not do well when the water gets warmer and it's gone. Okay, so that was good enough, in terms of pushing this this notion. Some of the greatest challenges were, frankly, internal in terms of other staff. The question about meteorologists earlier in our market among three major network affiliates, you got one meteorologist who swears this is reality and we're late. We got to work on it. We got one who swears it's a scam, and we got one who says, we can't come to a conclusion. So I look at them collectively as our audience. And, we just got to keep pushing it.
Hey, Mark, did you...
I just wanted to jump in on that one. As everyone has pointed out, we're coming to this discussion late, and that's a phenomenon that I think we'll see here in the next few years. The public, like the rest of us, responds to crisis and deadlines. And as the effects of global warming become more apparent, more visual, and there's more publicity, we may very likely see that, especially as the electronic market continues to fragment and advertisers begin to hold more sway over news institutions. Mm. And as newspapers continue to bleed circulation and advertisers, and advertisers begin to assert themselves as this hits, a crunch time out there someplace. Sort of affirm what I've been hearing from the other panelists, the best approach is deliberateness, accuracy, getting the information out as straightforwardly as possible. I don't believe that it's up. I was an editorial page editor, editorial writer for 25 years, wrote columns. I know the difference between objectivity and spin. The minute you spin it, you lose your credibility and you're going to lose your audience. Just to be as straightforward as possible is getting that news out. That's going to be a problem, I think, for some institutions. It hasn't been for us, and I hope it won't be and trust it won't be, but it could be a problem for some institutions.
You, sir.
Is this on? He's not from NPR, but I am. My name's David Barron. I'm science editor for the public radio program The World. And I want to share a frustration I have and get some feedback, which is, look, I'm here because this is the biggest story. We've been covering global warming for years. We don't put Fred Singer on the air. There's no need to have balance from the handful of skeptics who are funded by the coal industry. But when you come down to the specifics of what's happening to the moose in Minnesota or what's happening with hurricane intensity, there is legitimate scientific debate. There is. I mean, and so, Bill, getting to what you're saying about a professional journalist doesn't report what he doesn't know, when you come to the specifics, which you have to make the story relevant, don't you have to provide the balance at that level and have not the crazy skeptic, but the legitimate debate that's happening about how is the true phenomenon going to be translated into specifics on the ground? And when you do put those legitimate doubters in the story, are you undermining the sense the public's going to get about how real this is?
I would say no if you do it correctly. I don't like the word balance much at all. I think the magic word in our profession is fair. Three-year-old kids at the playground know what the word means.
Well, a fair portrayal of the debate that's going on.
Yes,
in the
and field. I agree with you entirely, because as Mark was saying at the other end of the table, credibility is the only guarantee we ever have to offer, and it depends entirely on us being hard-edged and making sure that we're presenting it well. Now, we should not think like propagandists, but my solution to that is this. It's not the journalist's job to give the audience what they want to hear about or what you think they ought to hear about. It's our job to give them what they didn't know that they would agree that they needed to learn until they learned it. And I don't know any easier way to say it. Now, what that means is, as long as I'm telling the audience things that, like when I meet them on a bus or anywhere else, and they say, why don't I know this? As long as they get that feeling, oh, my goodness, then we're giving them information that would seem to be appropriate for our profession. So balance isn't exactly the word I would use, but I would agree entirely that we have to keep looking for it. Now, by the way, folks, they're not sure about this or that, but don't let this confuse you. This is for certain. We just have to be mindful of that. Basically, common sense.
Throw in just two other words, and I think this is where you're headed, proportion and context. I mean, we've got to find those credible voices in opposition, but we need to put them in the proper context and also assign some proportionality to what they're saying, that if they're one voice out of 100, but they're credible, folks, this is one voice out of 100, but it's credible, listen to it and draw your own conclusions.
Okay, Stacy.
I'm Stacy Shelton with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and my question's to Mark Woodward and anyone else, really. But what did you do after that section ran? How have you covered it in your daily pages?
I don't know if everyone heard the question, but the question is, how did we continue to cover climate change after we published our special section? The work on the section woke us up to the university and also to the issue, but we've got this world-class institution in Upriver, and as other discoveries have been made, as they've come back from Patagonia or Greenland or the Antarctic, we had a story just the other day on the front page relating to climate change and also the work of the Climate Change Institute. So we're much more aware of it, and we're not capable of producing something on this order of magnitude on a regular basis, but we are capable of putting things out front now more often, and we're doing that.
Yes, sir.
Identify
yourself, please.
My name is Stan Glantz. I'm actually a scientist. I'm here to talk, and I'm a tobacco guy. I'm here as one of the speakers, and I just like to – I deal with you guys.
I'm sorry. We're going to take questions from SEJ members first. I'm sorry.
Oh. Okay.
All right,
you don't want to hear how a source views the discussion?
Well, that's the ground rules here, sir. I'm sorry about that.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. Well, if anybody wants to talk about it, I'll be around.
Misty.
I'm Mary Woodson, freelance journalist. And climate change is a secondary effect of rising atmospheric CO2. There are primary effects that could have...
Excuse me. Can you all hear in the back?
No.
You cannot. All right, you need to speak up some. All right, yeah, get really, really in there close. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, but close. Think about kissing.
Ah. Well, climate change is a secondary effect of rising carbon levels in the atmosphere, but there are primary effects that could have vast and sweeping implications for all life on Earth, for evolution, for competitive selection, for longevity, for our food supply. And so every time you put a gallon of gas in your car and you drive somewhere, you're putting about 9 pounds of aerial fertilizer on the earth. But I have not seen this story really much of anywhere. Are people aware of this? Are people working on this? It doesn't matter if the ice caps melt. It doesn't matter if the sea levels rise. It doesn't matter if the temperatures go up. It doesn't matter if there are more hurricanes. This is a vast, the primary effect of rising carbon dioxide. Climate change is secondary. Where's this story?
Mm-hmm. Does anybody want to take that?
Yeah, there's a lot of work that has been done on it. You're talking about like CO2 fertilization effects. Mm-hmm. And they've shown, you know, some interesting things. For example, poison ivy does very well in a high CO2 world. And that did get a lot of play. But I think in terms of, you know, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of primary effects of changing the atmosphere. You're clearly right, more direct, even than global warming. I think we have tended to focus on, you know, human impacts. There is a lot of interesting controversy, in fact, in the plant world. You know, a lot of food supply projections, people will tell you that used CO2 fertilization to sort of offset some of the drought predictions. And now people are going back and looking at those and saying for seed plants, which evolved in a low CO2 world, seed plants are not going to do any better in a high CO2 world. So food production is not going to do any better. So, you know, there are some interesting stories to be done there, but I don't know that effect from a human standpoint or even from an animal standpoint outweighs the indirect effects of climate change. In my reporting, I didn't come up against that.
Peter.
Hi, I'm Peter Thompson. I'm a radio producer and author from Boston organizer of the panel. I want to follow up on a question from earlier, particularly to Mark, but also to the rest of you. Now that your organizations have gotten their heads around this issue to a large degree, I'm curious how it's permeating your newsrooms in general, beyond the climate change beat, beyond the environment beat with a big E, how are your organizations integrating what we know about climate change into your broad coverage in general? Because this is something, as we all know, that doesn't stop at the environment beat. It doesn't stop at the weather. It stops at nowhere, really. It's affecting everything that we do as a society, everybody that we are, long into the future. So I'm just curious sort of how you're integrating this into your overall coverage over the long term.
I'll take a shot at that first. I would say at this point, not much. It has been a science and environmental and in some respects an education story, but beyond that, I don't think it's been, we're more aware of it, obviously, but I don't think it's been woven into the, you know, kind of the fabric of our news, the stories that we do for the newspaper and other areas.
Either you two?
I would say just that I think that it is seriously getting to a point now where we look at it like we look at the latest news that's developing in healthcare, the latest in education, the latest on global warming, climate change, what's happening with the environment. It's on that strata, okay, of news that we are paying attention to, looking at every day, and covering in the way that, you know, local news would cover things in terms of 15, 20 second stories, by and large, maybe a minute and a half if it was something that was particularly local and that we were going to put a local reporter on. But it's definitely on the radar. One thing I wanted to just say to you folks, too, before we're all done, is that anybody that wanted to see this piece in its entirety, the whole project, is still online, and it's at kare11.com/climate.
Yes.
I'm Kathy Regan. I'm a freelance writer from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I did ecosystems research for 15 years prior to this. My question to you is, as a former member of the scientific community, I think I'm sometimes too willing to let my scientist colleagues off the hook in terms of taking a strong stand, but I'm not sure that that's right. So what I want to know from any or all of you is there more scientists can and should be doing in terms of speaking out directly to these issues, or are they constrained by their real role and identity as professional scientists?
I think Elizabeth had some scientists who had some pretty strong opinions. Go ahead.
Well, I do think that's a real, that's another, you know, there's several parts to this equation of why, you know, we can all sit in a room and say that, you know, the biggest story on the planet hasn't gotten enough coverage. And I do think that scientists, and I think many scientists are thinking about this themselves, but that the norms of scientific communication, the kind of, you know, bland and incomprehensible language that many scientific reports that are reporting really, really dangerous phenomena in this language that's literally, I read maybe, you know, 150 scientific papers, and I wrote 30,000 words, and I don't think I quoted one, okay, because they're unquotable. And they're purposefully unquotable.
That's right.
And I think that when, you know, the future of the world is at stake, you know, we all have to examine what the norms of our profession are. And we're all talking about, you know, what are the norms of journalism and how should we be reevaluating that and why maybe they've failed us in this sense. And I think that scientists have to reevaluate that, too. They are very interested. They are very concerned. Their primary concern is getting that next grant from a government funding agency. That is a real tension in this case.
But just one quick thing here. There's some real leaders in this. Edward O. Wilson, James Hansen, Walter O'Shell, Michael Oppenheimer. They're leading the discussion among the scientists and getting on their cases saying we have a responsibility here while still protecting our objectivity. So it's a movement.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to try and squeeze in the people who are at the mics now, but we're very close, so okay. Go.
I'm Julie Grant with Public Radio in Ohio. And, you know, for those of us who started asking these questions a couple of years ago, which is fairly recent, but when you're working on local regional stories, sometimes it's hard to get the scientists in the area to make the tie to what we're seeing in the plant communities and some of the storms, things like that, to get them to make the connection to global warming or to climate change. So I guess I just wonder, I mean, any suggestions for people reporting on the local regional level?
Sure. Where I think you might find most luck in something like that is to actually go into the scientific community you have locally and just look for where you're less likely to find them to say, you know, this blowdown is a direct result or this, you know, whatever the specific event is. But they are more and more commonly as an organization of scientists meeting to look at the impacts of climate change in their own more regional, localized communities. And I found a lot of success in starting there where they're coming together meeting, either going to those meetings or reading those minutes and finding out who the players are there and trying to do it from that angle as opposed to any individual events.
Okay, we're right at the time, but we're going to take these other two questions. We've got about 2 minutes. Oh, sorry. Oh.
My name is Mira Monicum. I'm from the Yale School of Forestry. I'm wondering, in convincing, unfortunately, we're still convincing the public that climate change is happening. And we focus a lot on global warming, and it's very important to bring sort of, I think, global warming to the local level, as we saw from the news report. But one thing that I find difficult when convincing people about global climate change is how to respond to cold incidents and things like, you know, the snowstorm in Buffalo, and what are your opinions of how do we incorporate these other extremes into the whole picture of global climate change when so much of the focus has been on warming events?
What I've been using lately is literally the line, and whether I do it in print or TV, simple third grade science lesson. The warmer the air, the more moisture it holds, and so they've always predicted, folks, that global warming would also mean that there'd be more heavy precipitation in some areas. And people can, you know, as soon as you tell them it's third grade science, they get it, and that's why we're suddenly seeing much more rain in the Northeast and in the English coast. And it's just a matter, again, of not being afraid of this. The public's pretty smart. You know, it's not that complicated.
And again, if you roll that information into your presentation, if you put it in context, again, I'll shamelessly plug our climate change supplement that's over on the side of the room there. But one of the things we included is a timeline. And along the timeline is what 1816, I think, was the year there was no summer. That was due to a natural disaster half a world away, and people had snowstorms here in June and July. People need to know that there are aberrations, there are things that we're not going to be able to account for, that we may be able to account for, that have nothing to do with this larger problem that's evolving here.
Okay, sir, you get the last question.
Good. My name is Joe DeLeo. I was a former college professor. I'm a meteorologist and climatologist. I was the first director and co-founder of the Weather Channel. I was the chief meteorologist at WSI for 18 years, where I was also Dr. DuPont.
Get up close to the mic.
Okay. And I am a skeptic. I am not bought by oil, companies. I guarantee you I lived in New Hampshire and Vermont most of my life, and most of my money went that direction. and a skeptic is a term that I dislike. It's defined as a person who questions the validity of something purported to be factual. And it's a connotation that, like an agnostic in religion, we don't have a belief system. We're just contrarians. In actual fact, we are believers and not deniers. We believe we need to be better stewards of our environment and the resources that we have. We believe in climate change. The only constant in nature is change. We believe that man plays a role in climate change through urbanization, land use changes, and greenhouse gases and aerosols. But we also believe in natural cycles.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to get to a question.
Okay. Those natural cycles, Elizabeth, you're correct. The greenhouse gas models do predict, have predicted the warming that has occurred. The natural cycles in the oceans and the sun would have predicted the same warming.
Sadly, that's just not true.
I just don't know what to say.
Wrong.
I could show you that.
Okay. There have been very sophisticated models. I'd like to say for everyone in this room, out of NCAR, and you can go look at them, you can look them up on the web, about what proportion of any warming you could possibly attribute to natural cycles.
Let her finish her answer, and then you can go again.
I'm not a meteorologist, and I'm not a climatologist, but I do want to commend those to everyone in this room on the NCAR website.
Okay, and I'll mention that the NCAR is the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Did you have a follow-up, sir?
I have great respect for NCAR and the work that they do, but their models are incomplete with regards to the solar.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
And you're talking about the solar sunspots?
Solar contribution, and they do not reproduce these other natural factors better show the cooling that occurred in the middle century. They can't with their model.
You're speaking of a little ice age. Tell me those factors. Tell me the factors that you're talking about.
The middle part of the 60s and 70s.
Oh, okay, cold. Okay.
And Rick, in the 40 years ago in the 1960s, we were cold. It's not expected, not surprising that there's been changes since then. I think my point to you as a panel that this could be another WMD fiasco. Weather of mass destruction. You'll be kicking yourself if the solar scientists are right.
I really hope so.
That would be okay with us.
The sun goes to sleep in the next 30 years, and we turn colder, not warmer.
Thank you for a provocative last question.
I wish that were going to happen.
I would love to sit with any of you, and show you the natural factors and how they influence climate.
Okay, we're going to leave it there because we have 10 minutes to get downstairs. I want to remind everyone that the plenary is downstairs, starts in 10 minutes. I got you out of here a little late. I apologize.
Good job. Kept it rolling.